Chapter 3 Gifts and Horses Silks in Ancient China Woven Words My stargauge poem dreams of you, wounding thoughts with delight. Such countless star glimmers, they contain all your grief and love. In the midst of my grief, your face, such countless star glimmer delights. Su Hui, an extract from Stargauge, 4th century AD, translated by David Hinton. Sometime during the 4th century, Su Hui took the pain from her wounded heart and spun it into something remarkable. Her beloved husband, a government official, had been sent into exile in a remote desert many days' travel from their home. To make matters far worse, he had, almost the moment he arrived, taken another woman as a concubine, despite the deep feelings he professed to have for Su Hui. She was both furious and distraught. A stew of wounded pride, grief, and humiliation might seem poor nourishment for creativity. And yet somehow Su Hui managed to transfigure these emotions into the Stargauge, a silken poem with a structure whose intricacy wasn't equaled for 5 centuries. The work originally took the form of a grid, 29 characters by 29 characters, painstakingly embroidered in different colours onto a silk panel. It is both part and the apotheosis of a type of Chinese poetry called Hui Wen Shi, or reversible poems. This genre relies on the fact that, unlike Western languages, Chinese characters can be read in any direction. Reversible poems, as the name suggests, can be read both forward, starting top right and moving down, and backwards. Su Hui's Stargauge, however, goes further. Its unique structure allows the reader to wander in any direction, through the text, horizontally, vertically, or diagonally, stumbling across different readings as they do so. In all, it contains over 3,000 possible poems. It would have been a striking visual object, too, when Su Hui first created it. A silken paean to an obsessive love. Dreams are wearing my beauty thin, reads one line. I thrash through wounded passions. It is just the way thoughts feel. The original has long since been lost, but it was a large square covered with characters embroidered in 5 colours to map out separate sections of text, each of which followed distinct rules. The poem's name was taken from an armillary sphere, an instrument used to gauge the movement of the stars. Armillary spheres were composed of concentric metal rings, each of which corresponded to a different celestial meridian, and it was perhaps this structure that gave Su Hui the idea for her own work. The backbone of Stargauge is the 7-character phrases that act almost like a grid over the visual structure of the poem and correspond to the rings of an armillary sphere. These can be read in any order, and whenever the reader encounters a junction between these phrases, they can head off in another direction. Readings of these phrases alone generate 2,848 possible poems. What makes this work even more remarkable is the context in which it was written. The era was turbulent. A century later, Chinese historians dubbed the period from AD 303 to 439 the 16 Kingdoms because of its dizzying succession of short-lived dynasties. Many of these rulers were foreigners, Tibetans, Mongolians, and horse-riding Xiongnu from the Asian steppes, who brought with them alien customs and culture, and yet more unrest, as they tried to subdue rivals and either capitalize on or overturn the complex Chinese government operated by entrenched officials and elites. It was conspicuously not a time that valued women, so much so that it is remarkable that Su Hui was able to write at all, still less create thousands of literary compositions, as she is said to have done. Of this canon, Stargauge is all that survives. For this we should be grateful. It was excluded from collections for centuries, and at one point even lost entirely. Its rediscovery and resurgence are perhaps due to its lovelorn creation, which became a kind of folktale, retold in plays, novels, and poems. In the most popular rendition of the story, Suhui's motive for creating Stargage was to seduce her errant husband back to her. In this telling, once she had finished the final stitches, she sent the poem to him and he, realizing that she was incomparable, renounced his concubine and the pair were happily reunited. While this cleaves most closely to conservative values of womanly fidelity, it seems at odds with the materiality of the Stargage itself. The poem is, above all, fiendishly ambiguous. This was deliberate. Suhui herself described her poem as lingering aimlessly, twisting and turning. This seems an unlikely lure for a clever woman to use in so conservative a society. If the Stargage was indeed a silken plea for her faithless husband's return, it was laced with no small amount of venom. Not only was she superior to the other woman with whom he was involved, Suhui was also, even in the depths of her grief, superior to him. The Sound of Rain on Leaves. In the silkworm month, we strip the mulberry branches of their leaves. We take those axes and hatchets. Luxuriant are those young mulberry trees. The Book of Odes, 11th to 7th century BC. It is said that silk production began with that most Chinese of things, a cup of tea. This particular cup was grasped by Xi Ling, the young wife of the Yellow Emperor, who was sitting under a mulberry tree in the gardens of the palace. With a soft plink and a little splash of hot liquid, a cocoon fell from one of the branches above the Empress directly into the cup. Naturally enough, Xi Ling's first instinct was to fish the offending object out, but she found to her amazement that the tea had dissolved the cocoon. Instead of a solid, cream-coloured lump, what emerged was hank upon unbroken hank of silk thread, so much that the Empress Xi Ling was able to spread it over the gardens so that it looked like shimmering mist. This Chinese legend is only one of many woven around the production of silk. China, particularly the areas around the Yangtze and Yellow River basins, is the natural habitat of both the Bombyx mori silk moth and its principal food, the white mulberry. It is also where the insect was first domesticated. This has rendered the moth flightless and disinclined to move around much. Their life cycles have also been sped up artificially. In the wild, they would normally reproduce once a year, possibly up to three times in the tropics. Now commercial silk producers are able to raise up to eight generations in the same period. Bee mori goes through four stages, from egg, ova, to caterpillar, larva, to chrysalis, pupa, before finally becoming a moth, imago. The whole show lasts between 40 and 60 days. The adult moths are moon pale and hirsute with wings too weak to bear them in flight. Newly hatched females are born already fat with eggs. They release pheromones to attract males and then mate. In domesticated settings, this happens within minutes. Soon afterwards, the female will lay up to 500 eggs. Healthy ones are bluish-grey and oval-shaped, small enough to fit inside the letter O on a dime coin, and after 10 days or so will hatch into wavering caterpillars that can barely be seen with the naked eye. In the wild, eggs would be laid on the leaves of living mulberry trees. Domesticated silkworms are kept in well-ventilated, stacked trays. Here they loll and eat vast quantities of mulberry leaves brought to them by humans. So frenetic is this feeding that a shed full of silkworms sound, even from several meters away, like a torrential rainstorm in a forest. They use this gluttony to power an incredible transformation. Their bodies will increase up to 10 times in weight, molting 4 times to accommodate their rapidly expanding girth. By the time they are ready to pass on to their next life stage, the silkworms will be a creamy ivory, sometimes banded with darker rings of grey-brown, and around the length and breadth of a lady's pinky finger. A silkworm that is ready to pupate will become restless, moving more than usual until it finds a suitable place to build its cocoon. Spinning one can take up to 3 days, during which time the caterpillar will move its head continuously to and fro while it excretes silk from 2 pairs of spinnerets below its mouthparts. The silk proteins produced in glands are liquid in the silkworm's body, only becoming solid once they are forced through the spinnerets. Even though they are only a few inches long, each silkworm can create a continuous thread up to 1,000 meters long and 30 microns wide, around half the width of a human hair. As they spin the silk, they coat it with sericin, a kind of gum. Raw silk is sometimes known as silk in the gum, that stiffens the cocoons. It is this substance that was dissolved by the hot tea in Empress Xiling's cup. Although they vary greatly from individual to individual, cocoons are generally ovoid, roughly the size of a quail's egg, and range in colour from creamy white to a rich yellow-orange. If left to its own devices, once the cocoon is complete, the silkworm within would become a chrysalis, and then, some 15 days later, would tear its way out of both structures, having transformed itself into a moth. Although the legend of the Empress and her tea makes the production of silk sound like an easy distraction for a lazy afternoon, nothing could be further from the truth. Bee Maori are delicate and difficult to raise at each and every stage of their lives. Females will lay many eggs that simply will not hatch. These are often blackish in colour. During the month when they are caterpillars, they are voracious. Their food, mulberry leaves only, must be replenished every 3 to 4 hours, day and night. If your own stocks of mulberry leaves are exhausted, new sources must be found, and neighbours negotiated with to ensure a continuous supply. This is no mean feat. 12,000 caterpillars consume around 20 sacks of mulberry leaves each day. It has been estimated that producing a single kilogram of silk requires 220 kilograms of mulberry leaves. Indeed, the need for mulberry leaves was so acute in antiquity that it was forbidden to fell mulberry trees in the spring when the silkworms naturally bred. The leaves must be clean, dry, and not too hot. Those picked during the heat of the day have to be left to cool in the shade. Otherwise, the caterpillars that eat them might die. Silkworms are also prone to diseases. Scarlet disease can be discerned the moment they emerge from a molt. Their bodies will have a reddish tinge, and they will die shortly afterwards. Another disease turns the caterpillars black and smelly before they die. More gruesome still, when afflicted with yellow disease, their skin stretches tight over their swollen heads, and a yellow liquid oozes from their mouths. If, however, you manage to feed your silkworms enough, and they don't fall prey to disease, the result of your labours will be a crop of fat cocoons. A few of these will be left to hatch, ensuring future generations of silkworms, but most will be harvested for their silk. The first step of this process is to remove the outer layer of floss, which has a low tensile strength and can be used to pad out winter clothes. The cocoons are then steamed, baked or soaked in a saline solution, killing the chrysalis and preventing it from damaging its own silken sarcophagus when it emerges as a moth, and then immersed in hot water to remove the gummy sericin. Once this is done, the silk will have lost between 20 and 30% of its weight. The silken filaments will be pulled out of the water and reeled to straighten them and prevent tangles. These skeins are then usually twisted together to make thicker thread for weaving and dyed. For thousands of years, these skeins were a uniquely productive raw material. 5,000-year monopoly. Men plow, women weave. Chinese proverb. The 12th century emperor Hui Zong was an ineffectual ruler, but a skilled artist. Talent certainly shines through in court ladies preparing newly woven silk. Painted with ink, pigments, and gold on a long scroll of silk, it shows three groups of women, all engaged in various stages of processing textiles. In the far right, four women pound the silk. In the center, two ladies sit and sew on a jade green rug. To the left, another group stretch out a length of fabric. They are likely imperial concubines, then among the most elite women in Chinese society. They are attired in patterned, empire-waisted gowns in harmonious colors, cerulean, greens, apricot, and pinkish reds, with their hair teased into elaborate shapes and held in place with combs. To the uninitiated, the scene is about as decorous as could be imagined, but, as it happens, all three of the steps in silk processing shown are also tropes in erotic poetry. Pounding cloth, for example, was often used as a euphemism for a woman's desire. The emperor, using a silken canvas, was implying that these glamorous, silk-clad women were working out their frustrated longing for him by making yet more silk. Like other natural fibres, silk usually leaves few traces behind to be unearthed by archaeologists, so pinning down precise origins is a little like trying to catch a moth in flight while blindfolded. Sericulture likely first appeared between 6 and 7,000 years ago, where it helps form a picture of sophisticated cultures with a wide range of skills. Siying village, a Neolithic site, yielded a cocoon that had been neatly sliced in half sometime between 2200 and 1700 BC. In Tianchangyang, in southern China, a piece of tabby weave textile was found that dates back to around 2750 BC. Another Neolithic settlement, Jiahu in central Henan, provides still earlier evidence of silk production. Jiahu is famous for the richness of its cultural remnants. Bone flutes, the earliest playable musical instruments, were found there, as were the remains of a fermented drink made from rice, honey, and fruit. Traces of silk proteins, the material itself had long since degraded, were discovered in a group of tombs that were around 8,500 years old. Even then, it seems, silk was something special, something that people wanted to take with them. Remarkably, China remained the only place where silk from B. mori was produced for around 5,000 years. And while the material itself has decomposed, other artifacts relating to its production, needles, looms, and shuttle-like creations for bearing thread, remain. An ivory basin, decorated with what appears to be a pair of silkworms, and dating back to around 4,900 BC, was found at a Neolithic site called Hemudu. During the Shang Dynasty, which lasted from around 1500 to 1050 BC, an oracle bone script was developed, the earliest writing system in East Asia. Oracle bones were usually made from the scapulars of oxen or sheep, or occasionally the shells of turtles, which had questions incised on them and were used in divination. Around 1,000 have been translated, and 10% of these include silk-related words: mulberry tree, silkworm, silk goddess. Multifaceted uses of silk in China first began to emerge during the Shang Dynasty. As is so often the case, the role in which it has been best preserved is its role in death. Grave goods, such as jades, bronze vessels, and axe heads, were wrapped in silk, just as ancient Egyptian cultures wrapped theirs in linen. At Ma Wang Dui, an archaeological site in Changsha, central China, a series of elaborately decorated coffins were found nested, one inside another. In Tomb 1, the outermost of the four coffins was painted black without and red within, a pairing highly significant in mourning rituals, and the exterior with clouds and monsters. The innermost coffin had the same colour scheme, but was also wrapped in a feathered brocade covered with geometric designs. Silk manuscripts and a diagram illuminating the mourning dress system were also found, carefully wrapped, in another Ma Wang Duyan tomb. Centuries later, when senior grandmaster Shao Tu was buried in 316 BC in Hubei province, his tomb contained 77 different textiles, including 15 silk shrouds. Grave inventories sometimes stretch the truth of the silks actually included in the tombs. One such document, included in a tomb, sealed in 548, lists 1,000 pieces of brocade, 10,000 of damask, and a piece of yarn 1,090,000 feet long, which it airily explained would be used for climbing to heaven. Silk was woven into other religious rites. Sun Ma Xian, a Chinese historian from the Han Dynasty, 206 BC to AD 220, spoke approvingly of the Feng and Shan sacrifices that were traditionally carried out by rulers, which included the ceremonial receiving of three kinds of silk, as well as lambs and wild geese and pheasants. According to Sun Ma Xian, Emperor Yu's failure to practice these rituals led to his downfall. The two dragons, sent to his court from heaven, took their departure. Later Buddhist texts were wrapped in silk, as were statues. One 7th century Chinese pilgrim made a ritual robe to exactly fit a large Buddha carving at the Mahabodhi Monastery in northern India. The robe was made entirely from silks donated by devotees from Shandong. Silks were also given by emperors and elites as rewards for religious services. Amoghvadra, a tantric teacher who arrived in China around AD 720, received so much silk that you could apparently climb the pile like a sand dune. The production of silk was bound up from at least the time of Confucius, with ideas about woman's appropriate place in society. As early as the Chia dynasty, circa 2070 to 1600 BC, women were expected to stay at home and devote themselves to weaving. A text from the 4th century BC was explicit on this point. Early in the morning, the women rise. Late in the night, they go to bed, spinning and weaving. That is their share in the work. The association between women and silk was further strengthened by the emergence of a silkworm spirit or silkworm goddess as early as the Shang Dynasty, 1500 to 1050 BC. This was often personified as Xiling, the wife of the Yellow Emperor whose mythic cup of tea launched the silk industry. Worship of her can be traced in one form or another right up to the factory workers of 19th century Shanghai. The goddess may owe the persistence of her cult over the millennia to a certain resistance against traditional cultural norms in spaces dominated by women. Confucian values meant that it was difficult to have cultural heroines, but this goddess, like Su Hui, prevailed. Annual rituals and offerings, often in the form of woodblock prints, were pegged to the seasons when the silkworms hatched and became an important part of the cultural calendar. During the Ming Dynasty, a building dedicated to Lady Xiling was erected in Beihai Park, an area just north of the Forbidden City in Beijing, and her birthday was celebrated on the 12th of December each year. One of the signature uses of silk, and the one with which we can readily identify with today, was as a mark of status. The Book of Rites, which is said to have been compiled by Confucius, 551 to 479 BC, proclaims that the coffin of a ruler is lined with red silk, fixed in place with nails of various metals. That of a great officer is lined with black silk, fixed with nails of ox bone. That of a common officer is lined, but has no nails. During the Shang and Zhou eras, circa 1600 to 256 BC, jade and silks were the most treasured gifts exchanged among the aristocracy. Just as jade could be inscribed with symbolic forms, silk could be woven or embroidered with patterns that held significance. Fabrics produced around the lower Yellow River were given enticing names such as auspicious pattern, four clustering clouds, mirrored flower, and nimble waves. Weavers responded to demand by creating ever more elaborate designs that varied enormously over time. Bright colors were popular during the Tang Dynasty, for example, while a muted palette was preferred during Song times. Song Dynasty Han Chou weavers also produced special silks for social occasions. Spring streamers, lantern globes, and boat racing are three of the most picturesque. When the Silk Roads brought outside influences into China, the silks reflected this. Symbols from Greece, India, and Persia all left their mark on fabrics woven in China. Emperors were particularly preoccupied with the prestige of luxurious silks. A yoky yellow shade, which was very labor-intensive to achieve, was reserved exclusively for emperors by law from the 7th century. Palaces had silk dyeing and weaving facilities. Reigning empresses presided over a silkworm department. When Emperor Changzong ascended the throne in 1190, he employed 1,200 weavers to produce prestigious patterned damasks. Sumptuary laws restricted certain silk fabrics to specific classes. A garment made from silk that had been dyed before it had been woven, for example, could only be worn by someone above ordinary officer level. Dragon robes were among the most exclusive silk fabrics in imperial China. These robes, which fastened at the side and were worn with a collar, were favored by courtiers, often given as gifts by the emperors, and their decoration was rich in symbolism. During the Qing Dynasty, medium-ranking officials wore robes with eight dragons, while those of a higher rank had an extra dragon, often hidden underneath the outer layer near the fastening. In the palace, care of these garments was exclusively entrusted to a director of the imperial wardrobe. Providing the silk for such diverse uses required a great deal of work and innovation. The backstrap loom, a very early form of weaving technology that used the weight of the weaver's body to produce the necessary tension on the warp threads, was in use at least 7,000 years ago. Demand soon ensured many other and often highly specialized looms were invented and put to use. To ensure a steady supply, silk production was ruthlessly organized with quotas and production qualities that went into granular detail. During the Chu Dynasty, an official bureau was set up to deal specifically with sericulture throughout the kingdom. For hundreds of years, there were, broadly speaking, three different strands of production. Firstly, women in farming households produced silk that was used to pay annual taxes. Although it was small scale on the individual level, this accounted for a great deal of the silk produced in China. In 1118, for example, a total of 3.9 million bolts of silk were produced for taxation purposes. There were also professional weaving households who crafted fashionable, technically difficult silk fabrics and whose livelihood depended on their selling them. Thirdly, there were state-operated and palace-run workshops that made silks for court and imperial robes. These were large-scale affairs. During the reign of Empress Wu Zetian, AD 685 to 705, the imperial manufactories employed 5,029 people, including 27 stockkeepers, 17 scribes, and 3 accountants. The palace manufacturer alone employed 83 damask workers and 42 highly skilled artisans. Much later, during the Ming Dynasty, 1368 to 1644, an imperial decree set up an official silk production centre in Nanjing, with 300 looms and instructions to make 5,000 bolts of silk each year. As well as having deep cultural resonance, as can be seen from its three-layered role in Court Ladies, substrate, subject, and innuendo, silk was an important source of wealth. By 1578, about 10% of the annual state revenue was spent on the production of silk by the central government. But even well before then, the production of silk was vital economically. A Qin statute punished anyone who stole mulberry leaves with 30 days' forced labour, even if the stolen goods are not worth a single coin. Rivalries between states could flare up over silk production. This sensitivity can be seen in the negotiations that followed the 589 BC invasion of Lu in today's Shandong province by the Chu state. Peace was only declared after Lu agreed to part with 100 woodcarvers, needleworkers, and weavers, workers who would bring their skills to Chu. Most simply, silk was, in many instances, used in place of currency. An inscription on a Chu Dynasty bronze tripod records the exchange of a horse and some silks for 5 slaves. During the reign of Wang Mang, from AD 9 to 23, a plain bolt of silk could be exchanged for around 60 kilograms of rice, while finer silk might be exchanged for 80. And although the domestic market dominated production, it would be a mistake to think that the Chinese weren't concerned with foreign trade at all. Oral Stein, who explored the region in the early 20th century, discovered silk strips at a ruined watchtower on the edge of the Gobi Desert, an important trading way station. One strip bore the incredibly helpful inscription, "A roll of silk from Kang Fu in the kingdom of Jensheng, width 2 feet and 2 inches, length 40 feet, weight 25 ounces, value 618 pieces of money." When the Song Dynasty collapsed in 1127, a new workshop for making rich damask was founded with the specific aim of making silks that could be traded with Tibetan tribesmen in return for horses. Later, silk lent its name to the network of trade routes that spread across Central Asia, the Silk Roads. While the majority of these exchanges were animated by the spirit of commerce, others were motivated by fear. Gifts for enemies. The Xiongnu live in the desert and grow in the land which produces no food. They are abandoned by heaven for being good for nothing. Discourse on Salt and Iron, 81 BC. To those living in northern China in the centuries before and after AD 0, there were probably few things as terrifying as the Xiongnu. These tribesmen, who ruled the Mongolian steppes, were renowned as tough, skilled, and brutal warriors. More unnerving still, their nomadic way of life was anathema to the Han Chinese. The Shichi, written between 110 and 90 BC, calls them mountain barbarians and characterizes them as little more than savages. They have no walled cities or fixed dwellings, nor do they engage in any kind of agriculture. They have no writing, and even promises and agreements are only verbal. The boys start out by learning to ride sheep and shoot birds and rats with a bow and arrow, and when they get older, they shoot foxes. Thus, all young men are able to use a bow and act as armed cavalry in time of war. Their boldness in battle also made them terrible neighbours for the Han, and the two skirmished for centuries, playing tug-of-war over the same ground. During this period, the tribesmen launched raid after raid on their southern neighbours, stealing livestock, taking them for slaves, and then melting back into the steppes before Han forces could be mustered and counterattacks launched. What the Chinese lacked in martial force, however, they were determined to compensate for with cunning. Their plan for subduing the unruly Xiongnu required a great deal of time and a secret weapon, one which they were confident would ultimately deliver them victory. That weapon was silk. The strategy was diplomatic in nature. The first step was to come to an agreement with the Xiongnu. In practical terms, this agreement, now known as the tributary system, had four tenets. Firstly, a Chinese princess would marry the Xiongnu, the Xiongnu leader. Secondly, the Great Wall would mark the border between the two sides. Crossing over the wall without permission constituted a breach of the agreement. Thirdly, the two parties would be equal, brotherly states, with neither one subservient to the other. Later, the Xiongnu had to submit to being a tributary state rather than an equal one, but this didn't nullify the other three parts of the agreement. The fourth part was where the silk came in. Legal trade was encouraged between the two nations, special markets were set up for the purpose near the wall, and stocked to the brim with all the goods that the tribesmen had been so eager to steal. Furthermore, the bonds of friendship between Xiongnu and Chinese leaders would be renewed annually with exchanges of gifts. Nominally, these were the exchanges of gifts between brotherly leaders. In practice, it appears to have been little more than a protection racket. The first agreement of this kind was reached in 198 BC, but it was continually being broken and rebrokered. In the year AD 135, for example, steppe horsemen held up a caravan of over 1,000 ox-drawn carts. More infuriating still, these carts were likely bound for one of the large border markets, set up specifically to entice the Xiongnu to abandon their marauding ways in favour of legal and profitable trade with the Chinese. Earlier, in 177 BC, the Xiongnu invaded some Hun allies. Peaceful relations were renewed 3 years later, when an envoy was dispatched to Emperor Wu, apologising on the one hand, while on the other, boasting of the strength of the Xiongnu forces and of their many recent military victories. The emperor got the hint. He sent 10 rolls of embroidery, 30 of brocade, and 40 rolls each of red and light green silk, as well as some of his own robes. "Your envoy tells us that you have led your troops in person," he replied, "and won merit, suffering great hardship on the field of battle. We therefore send you from our own wardrobe an embroidered robe lined with patterned damask, an embroidered coat and lined underrobe, and a brocaded coat." As time passed, the gifts the Xiongnu court demanded grew ever larger. While in 51 BC they received 6,000 catties of silk floss, a catty is a unit of measurement then roughly equivalent to 605 grams, and 8,000 pieces of silk fabric, by AD 33 they were getting 16,000 and 18,000 respectively. Silks were an important status symbol for the tribal leaders and were, as in China, often buried in the tombs of the elites. A large number of such fabrics have been excavated in northern Mongolia. Noan Ula, for example, a site with over 200 burial mounds belonging to elite Xiongnu, is brimming with Chinese goods, including precious damasks likely given as part of the tributary system. Given the mounting costs of the tributary system and the regularity with which the pact was broken, it might be wondered why the Chinese persisted. It was partially expediency. The Xiongnu certainly valued the gifts and the special markets that were set up for them. These were part of their diplomatic requests when the two nations patched up their differences after the raid in AD 135. The Han likely hoped that these agreements would discourage, if not completely stop, the aggression. More deviously, they believed that trade would weaken their foes financially. The Chinese produced more desirable luxury goods than the nomadic tribesmen did, so it was likely the balance of trade would always be in their favour. What the Xiongnu did have to trade were pack animals like camels, donkeys, and horses. Since these were vital to the Xiongnu's military success, the more of them that passed into Chinese hands, the better. As one Han official put it in 81 BC, a piece of Chinese plain silk can be exchanged with the Xiongnu for articles worth several pieces of gold, and thereby reduce the resources of our enemy. Mules, donkeys, and camels enter the frontier in unbroken lines. Horses, dapples and bays, and prancing mounts come into our possession. But there was an even longer term and more insidious motive behind the Han tolerance of the expensive tributary system. They believed that by giving the Xiongnu fine textiles, food, and other trappings of their own civilization, they would weaken them militarily. Their hope was that they would become so economically and culturally dependent on China and their luxury goods that the Han would have achieved through shrewd diplomacy and patience what they couldn't with warfare. Xia I, 201 to 169 BC, articulated this scheme. He picturesquely called it the Five Baits strategy early on. The delicious foodstuffs, entertainment, music and women, buildings, granaries and gorgeous clothes, he argued, would act on the Xiongnu as the haircut did on Samson. The Xiongnu, in turn, were aware of the danger posed by the gifts they were being sent. A Han official who defected to them told them bluntly that they were being played for fools. The strength of the Xiongnu lies in the very fact that their food and clothing are different from those of the Chinese. From now on, when you get any of the Han silks, put them on and try riding around on your horses through the brush and brambles. In no time your robes and leggings will be torn to shreds, and everyone will be able to see that silks are no match for the utility and excellence of felt and leather. Silk bound the aggrieved wife Su Hui, the vain Emperor Huizong, and the leaders wrestling with the aggressions of the Xiongnu together. Each used it as the medium for their narrative of seduction. It allowed Su Hui, a woman in a misogynistic age, a voice. Silk making was explicitly reserved for women in Confucian thought. Not only was it one of the things that they were able to materially contribute to society, but embroidery and textiles were one of the arenas in which they could excel. Ding Pei, the author of the Treatise on Embroidery in the 19th century, told her readers that the needle is your writing brush, and spoke of it explicitly as a worthy art form. It should, she wrote, be imbued with emotions, so that a many-storied tower can appear in an inch of cloth without seeming small. Su Hui used both her brain and her skill with the needle to create a silken text that, depending on what you believe, either won her lover back through the force of its brilliance or cowed him into submission. Emperor Huizong used a different silken canvas to talk about love. He deployed his talents to paint a scene that showed others desiring him. Moreover, the women, likely imperial concubines, were among the most powerful and influential women of his day. Their sumptuous clothing adds to their allure, and, indirectly, to his own virility. Emperor Huizong was, in a sense, using the shared cultural value and language of silk to mythologize himself as a desirable, powerful man, no matter what the opinion of his contemporaries. The seduction of the Xiongnu was more insidious. The Han were confident in the power of their fabrics to dampen the tribesmen's ardour for battle. Silk was, after all, treasured by the nomads because of its texture, and because it was lightweight, making it easier to carry on horseback. The tribesmen, particularly the elites, began to use it for their clothing and bedding, and incorporated it into their burial rituals. Just as in China, the ownership of precious silks became a talisman of prestige. It was an important part of the way the Xiongnu cemented his position. Just as in China, where sumptuary laws delineated one class from another using the colour and quality of silken fabric. Silk was power.